Doe versus State. Want to come forward?
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor. John Doe, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, if I may.
3 minutes? You may.
The statute provision in question offends a menu of constitutional protections, which Doe has outlined in his brief. The number of violations are too long to go into detail here. However, they were all bound together by one glaring error that the Superior Court made, and that was the level of review, the level of scrutiny that the court used in analyzing Doe's claims. Now, the court didn't write an opinion, so it's not clear what analysis was performed. But it does appear clear that the level of review used by the court was the rational basis standard, because Doe was required to show that the law was unconstitutional. If a higher level review was required, then the state would have had to borne that burden. Now, Doe's claims here are distinguishable from all other case law on registration in the state of Washington, because up to this point...
What are you saying is the appropriate level of scrutiny for the trial court in assessing Doe's constitutional challenge?
Okay. At minimum, the intermediate scrutiny, given in the importance of the right to travel, and I was going to get into that, the Ninth Circuit in Nunez v. the City of San Diego, which I didn't brief, made a statement regarding that point that, quote, the court has applied an intermediate scrutiny to certain disadvantaged classes that were not not suspect classes, and to important rights that were not fundamental rights, unquote. So it doesn't have to be a fundamental right, which the right to travel could be, though we're not clear on that yet, to travel out internationally. But at minimum,
it's important. Isn't the case law pretty clear about that, that international travel is not a fundamental right?
Well, the Ninth Circuit in Unique ruled on restricting passports to deadbeat parents. And in there, there was a plurality of decisions. There were three opinions. The lead opinion said a rational basis review was required. The dissent said strict scrutiny was required. And then the concurring opinion said intermediate scrutiny. So the federal courts are a little conflicted on the right to travel internationally.
This is a little bit different, though. I mean, at least in the sense of whether travel is being restricted completely. If you take your passport, you can't go anywhere.
That's true.
That's certainly not the circumstance we have here.
But it is a prior restraint, which that the registration is now imposing, which it hasn't done up to this point. There's been no case law that says, well, in fact, all case law says that registration up to this point has been regulatory precisely because there was no prior restraint imposed on an offender. So I think that's why those claims here are distinguishable than any other case law. The Ward opinion, which upheld the initial statute for registration, was very simple at the time.
Can you clarify what sort of challenge you're bringing to the statute? Is this a challenge, a facial challenge that is just blanketly unconstitutional in any circumstance, or is it as applied?
Well, certainly it's as applied and retroactive to Doe. And I think there's a facial challenge here, too, for any free citizen who is not under any court restriction or obligation. So to come... especially retroactive, to impose a prior restraint to travel is something that is certainly not regulatory. And it's so primarily it's a retroactive as applied to Doe here, but I think there's also a facial challenge here as well.
If it's an as applied challenge, don't you have to actually try to exercise the right, and then the government does something, so we know how it works.
Well, under Steffel v. Thompson, Doe doesn't have to have traveled under the statute to be able to bring a claim against the law that restricts his ability to exercise his constitutional right. Now, there's an affidavit in here that where Doe has traveled to another state and wished to travel to Mexico, but was prevented from doing that because he could not provide 24 hours notice, let alone 3 weeks notice, to the state of Washington when he wasn't present in the state to do so. So Doe claims that he has been restricted from travel, but I don't believe that he has to have standing here to challenge the statute.
What's the difference between that circumstance and a person who goes to Arizona decides they want to cross the border, but then they forgot their passport?
Well, a person can still get back into his country eventually, but that's a mistake that that person has made himself. It's not an imposition by the state. The state here is imposing a requirement that Aviv is unconstitutional.
But if you knew you were going to go to Arizona and you might want to cross the border, could you not make arrangements before you left for Arizona to cross the border?
It's true if Doe had at that time before he left to go to Arizona knew, but even if he could provide notice.
There's no difference between that and a person with a remembering to bring their passport, is there?
Well, the difference here is that Doe has to provide specific detailed information about when and where he's going to travel across the border. And that prevents him from any impromptu travel, which any businessman may know that he can't plan 3 weeks ahead if he's traveling to meet and work with clients. So, but this, again, is a state imposition and not something that perhaps a traveler himself has to worry about his day-to-day. I mean, he has to have certain documents when he travels, surely. That's up to him to remind him. He has to remember to bring those things. Now, certainly the right to travel internationally is important. The U.S. Supreme Court in Africa says that that right is protected by the Fifth Amendment. And our state Supreme Court in Eggert v. Seattle referenced the Magna Carta and the United Nations Declarations of Human Rights when describing how important the right to travel is. So clearly the right to travel internationally is important. And as we just mentioned here, it's not clear whether that's a fundamental right or just an important right. But I don't believe it has to be fundamental for this court to look at that and apply the Fifth Amendment protection to that to prevent the state from imposing a prior restraint. I guess I'll just go ahead and reserve the rest of my time here and unless you have any other questions.
Right. You'll have 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you,
Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Paul Crisali, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the state. There are two flaws at the heart of Doe's constitutional challenges. First, Doe can still travel. He only needs to provide notice before doing so. Second, any responsibilities imposed on registered offenders are rationally related to the government's interest in protecting the public.
What is the proper level of scrutiny that we ought to apply?
In this case, it's rational basis.
And you say that because what?
Two reasons. First, looking to Unique, I have yet to figure out the pronunciation of that case. I think that the majority or lead opinion is very persuasive in explaining how you apply that to the travel context. But I would add, we're not even dealing with the travel context. We're not dealing with the travel with a fundamental right. We're dealing with notification prior to travel. And so it doesn't implicate some sort of fundamental right. It just.
What if you're in the 3 week gap and you're not near your home state? Doesn't it effectively prevent you from traveling?
It can if you don't meet the 24-hour exceptions. But yes, you will need to provide notice and you will need to plan for that. But it is just notice still that's required. So you can still travel, just not within that 21 days.
I'm a sports fan, and I find out that my team is qualified for the Stanley Cup, and they're playing next week in Ottawa. This wouldn't let me go.
It might not.
It's not an emergency.
Well, it would be left to the circumstances of that case, whether it would be a family emergency or a work emergency, depending on the circumstances, such that
it strikes me there are lots of situations where travel plans are made in less time than 3 weeks.
True, but I think that's less so. That happens less in the context of international travel. You do have to have a passport. Having preconditions before traveling internationally is not new, even outside of the registered offender context. You have to get passports. You have to do visas. You have to go through customs.
Generally don't. I'm on a fly to Europe. I'm looking in the Sunday New York Times, and there's a deal on flights next week. I always have my passport, and it's got at least 6 months left on it. I can't take advantage of it because of the 3 week rule.
Well, this is identified registered offenders for purposes of obtaining the information and have sharing. There is a requirement and a precondition before traveling that they need to meet, and it's an important one. For
why is it rational to be 3 weeks if I can walk in the door personally and give 24 hours notice, and that provides whatever protection the government thinks is appropriate? But if it's not an emergency, the government needs to know 3 weeks in advance. Why isn't this too long a period of time?
Well, I think it's up to the legislature to decide the period of time that they think is necessary.
If it's reasonable.
Well, that the legislature thinks is necessary for purposes of receiving the information from the offender, forwarding it to the U.S. Marshal, having the U.S. Marshal forward that to Interpol and other agencies. I think they provide, I learned from watching the legislative history in the committee, they send like a green card to the receiving country, give them adequate notice, and ultimately it can provide enough time for that country, if they have a problem with this offender coming in, notify the offender that they're not going to be coming in. They're not going to find out at the airport upon getting there that they weren't permitted in that country. So this at least allows, 21 days notice allows time to go through that whole process. It can be sped up in the case of an emergency, but the system's designed that way. If there's a lot of travel going on, the sheriff's offices aren't going to be inundated with these notifications and then have to forward them on and go from there.
And the 24 hours is only for emergency?
That's actually, I've used that as the example. It's also routine business travel. And I can provide statutory definition.
Do the regulations allow for that to be done by Skype or anything else that would reasonably facilitate flexibility?
I am unaware of any regulations that have interpreted that provision. And so
it says in person, doesn't it?
It does say in person and provide in writing an explanation as to why it was impracticable. I don't know if a sheriff's going to deem Skype or anything else as in person.
Doesn't that render that option virtually worthless?
No, because you can still appear in person at the sheriff and within 24 hours and go about your business. Or
what happens if it's a Sunday?
I don't know if all sheriff's offices are closed on Sundays or not.
Mine is.
Then you'll have to plan for an additional 24 hours in that case, and that's left to funding problems that might exist within particular sheriff's offices. This statute envisions planning while also providing for emergencies, and that's what the legislature, in crafting this, is providing a requirement for notice, not to deter travel. And that's what the case is about, is just creating this precondition that not only benefits public safety but also can benefit the offender. Which goes to the next step. The law satisfies rational basis because the government's interest in protecting the public outweighs the responsibility placed on offenders to provide advance notice.
Which public is being protected with this statute?
Well, Washingtonians, I
mean, if it's foreign travel, who's it protecting?
It's protecting both Washingtonians as well as the receiving country.
How does it protect Washingtonians?
Because as the U.S. Department of Justice in 2008 explained in their guidelines regarding this, there's a reciprocal benefit by providing this information to the other countries. The system, the information sharing that goes on has to work by the states providing the information to U.S. Marshals and sharing that with other countries. There's going to be an expectation that when offenders come into the United States and come to Washington, we know as well that they are here.
So the price of getting good information from foreign countries is providing information to them?
It can be, yes. And
is that a hope, or is there some agreement that that's what that what will happen?
I've yet to find the official treaty that does this. My understanding is there is an information sharing agreements between countries where they do share this with each other. And I would note, this also has been a law supported by the criminal bar when it was proposed to the legislature, out of a concern that they wanted consistency in the law and an ability to provide advice to their clients about federal laws affecting their ability to travel abroad for registrants. And so we have to keep that in mind, that this also benefits registrars in that they're being told what they have to do, how it can help comply with federal requirements, that way they're not picked up while trying to travel abroad. The statute is also not punitive in that it doesn't really add much more than what already exists. In fact, it fits nicely within the system that existed before or that was enacted by this legislation, in that it's all about notification within Washington, making sure that we have this information and then share it as necessary. It's not unduly burdensome on an individual because they can still travel, they can still go to whatever country they'll be permitted to go to. They just have to provide the notice, and they have to account for that time frame. And
does the sheriff have any authority to deny travel plans?
Not by the statute.
Does he, from any other source?
I could potentially.
There's no court order prohibiting it.
That was the line I was thinking, as if there was some sort of community.
Assuming
custody
there's
order.
No community supervision or any other sort of order limiting the individual's freedom.
I know of no law that would restrict, would have a sheriff restrict an individual's ability to travel abroad.
Does this supplant the federal registration or take its place, or do they both have to be satisfied for travel purposes?
Well, I guess it's unclear to me what you mean by federal registration, in that my understanding is there is no federal registration scheme where you register with the federal government. It's through the states, and they share the information with the U.S. Marshals and then go
so
from there.
So is this required by the federal statute, then? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, it's consistent with some federal statute, the Adam Walsh Act, I believe.
You say consistent, but other states don't have this same scheme, which suggests to me the federal statute requires something less.
Well, there was a U.S. Supreme Court case interpreting the federal scheme, Nichols v. U.S., just this last term, and it is consistent with federal laws requiring.
Okay, there's a difference between being consistent with and being required by the federal statute. The federal statute required 1 week's notice, and the state of Washington required 3 weeks' notice. Washington would be consistent, but 3 weeks wouldn't be required by the federal statute. So which is it here? Is it consistent or is it required?
If I can finish my answer. I would say it's consistent. There may be some funding components that come with it, but that's a more complicated discussion about how Washington sets up its registration scheme compared to what is required by federal law. And that was addressed by the legislature in making the decision for a scheme.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There are actually 50-plus registries in this country, and they're all a little bit different. Some states do not require DOE and other offenders that may require to be registered in Washington to be registered there. For instance, in Alaska, DOE has a court order interpreting law that he doesn't have to register there. He doesn't have to register in Texas. And as the court points out, there are some states that do not require this international travel notification. So it depends on where you live. Of whether or not you have to provide this notification requirement in Washington. So it's kind of odd that Washington has the right to restrict foreign travel, but if DOE is in another state, he doesn't have to provide that. So I'm not sure that the state of Washington has the authority, where it could get its authority to restrict international travel. And as the court kind of alluded to, is there a public safety issue here for Washington citizens when DOE is in another state abiding by the laws there? And I would say no, it does not. The statute should be suspect because of the targeted group in which it imposes this requirement. The Sixth Circuit ruled recently in the Michigan case that the state could not apply some of these retroactive registration requirements because they were considered punitive. And the court made an interesting statement, or a couple of points I'd like to point out here. First is that the court said that there was no evidence that offenders as a group have a higher rate of recidivism than any other group. And second, that court said
the law in Washington, though, is that its registration is not punitive. I mean, that's has been decided, and that's our Supreme Court.
That's the law up to this point. Now the question is this amendment make it punitive? And what I was alluding to here is that there are many cases across the country where the courts have said these amendments have gone too far and now have become punitive. In fact, I wanted to make this one quote that the Sixth Circuit said regarding these amendments to that state's registration. The court said, indeed, the fact that sex offenders are so widely feared and disdained by the general public implicates the core counter-majoritarian principle embodied in the ex post facto clause, unquote. So the court should also look at the targeted group which the state is imposing this requirement, given that it's a group that is really disdained by the public. And so it should take a very close look to see if it is rationally related to what it's trying to achieve and whether it has stepped over the line and imposing too many restrictions on offender. And with that, I'd like to summarize that I believe that the trial court erred in the level of review at which it used in reviewing the case, and I would ask this court to either remand back to have a higher level of review used or to alternatively rule that the statute itself, that provision, is unconstitutional.
Thank you. Our next case.